The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I've always been fascinated by SDS, and I think a lot of people are fascinated by SDS because it really provides this unique window into the main years of radicalization of the 1960s. It was formed in 1960, and for all intents and purposes dissolves by 1969, but in that window covers kind of all of the major periods of radicalization of the 1960s. And certainly the 1960s is seen rightly as a decade of student revolt. Many of the early civil rights protests were led and organized by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which I'll talk a little bit about in conjunction with SDS. But certainly just the people who, you know, organized the sit-ins, went down for the Freedom Summers, certainly formed the base of the anti-war movement, which was largely based on campuses, were students. And in 1968 itself, the demonstration of students in Mexico City, the demonstration of students in Prague, and then most spectacularly, the student demonstrations in May of 1968 in Paris, really came to symbolize the radicalization of the 1960s. And in the United States, SDS was the largest student organization at its height, had close to 100,000 members. And so I think together those two things can give you a unique window into how people radicalized through that period, and for activists today can provide lessons. I think, like as Paul says in his article in Jacobin, I think like many of the organizations of the 1960s, those lessons are double-edged. There's both positive lessons to learn and certainly many, many negative lessons for us to take away as we begin to rebuild a new left today. But also because SDS provides this window into the radicalization of the 1960s, it's also been the subject of intense criticism, very often by former members of the organization itself. So a whole number of former leaders of SDS, including Todd Gitlin, Tom Hayden, Mark Rudd, Jack Berman, have all written histories of SDS that are incredibly critical and kind of continue this idea that's very popular throughout writings on the 1960s, of dividing the decade into kind of a good 1960s and a bad 1960s. The good being when students marched in suits and in the streets and were nonviolent and argued for basic reforms, and then sometime around like 1966, everyone went fucking crazy and started talking about revolution. This is when a couple years later, John Lennon will write Revolution, and you know, if you're carrying around pictures of Chairman Mao, no one will listen to you anyhow. And the argument that it was really precisely the radicalization that took place in the late 60s that was responsible for the collapse of the movements of the 1960s. And at one point, Todd Gitlin even goes so far to say that SDS really bears responsibility for getting Nixon elected and the continuation of the Vietnam War. So what I want to try to do is go through some of the history, but also try to paint a picture of the very real challenges and impasses that student radicals were facing. And that the move towards revolutionary politics was an understandable outgrowth of those attempts to break through those impasses, and the fact that the ideas of kind of Cold War liberalism and social democracy hadn't been able to provide a way forward for the movement. The tragedy, of course, is that the ideas that activists found as they moved towards revolutionary politics themselves were not necessarily the ideas of revolutionary Marxism, of socialism from below, of working class self-emancipation, but one or another variant of Stalinism, and themselves couldn't provide a way forward. And that's where I think we have to take some very critical lessons as well about the type of politics that will be necessary to rebuild a new left. So SDS begins in 1960. It was connected to an organization that had been around much longer, the very unfortunately named SLID, one of the worst acronyms in the history of the left. But it stood for the Student League for Industrial Democracy. It was the student wing of an organization called the League for Industrial Democracy that was a social democratic organization that had been around for years, going back to the early parts of the century. It had a commitment to kind of broad support of social democracy, the expansion of rights and democracy in the United States. But his politics were particularly kind of circumscribed by three important pillars. One was uncompromising hostility to anything connected to communism, whether that was the Soviet Union abroad or anything around connected to the Communist Party at home. And I think sometimes today the Cold War anti-communism can seem somewhat far removed from where we are today, but it's important to remember that this destroyed entire organizations. SANE, which was one of the forerunners of peace action today, was blown apart in the late 1950s when it was discovered that one of its organizers in New York was a former Communist Party member, and the entire organization exploded. The League for Industrial Democracy was firmly within that anti-communist wing of social democracy. Second was a support for seeing the Democratic Party as one of the central vehicles for change in the United States and working with and inside of it. And third was support for the labor movement, which in the particular form it took really meant, particularly because of the decline of rank and file activism, the gutting of the unions that had taken place during McCarthyism, particularly meant connection and support for the trade union bureaucracy and the trade union leadership, whether of a left-wing variant, like people like Walter Reuther, who maintained some connection to the left, or grudgingly in the case of people like George Meany, who were like the ultimate epitomes of business unionism and Cold War pro-US imperial support within the trade unions. Students for a Democratic Society, they changed their name in 1960, and initially their outlook on the one hand is shaped by the politics of the League for Industrial Democracy, but they also reflect the outlook of a new generation, a generation of radicals brought up during the Cold War and rebelling against the kind of stultifying conformity of the 1950s, the emphasis on consumerism. I mean, the epitome being, if anybody saw Alan Moss's talk yesterday on the 50s, kind of epitomized by the Leave It to Beaver kind of image of the nuclear family and that kind of stultifying conformity on the one hand, and also a complete hypocrisy that whole sections of this country, particularly if you were black, in the United States, and certainly in what the U.S. did outside of its borders, supporting dictatorship and oppression abroad. And so initially, the activists around SDS reflected both sides of that. On the one hand, they reflected a layer of middle class intellectuals who, in their own words, in the words of the Port Huron Statement, which became their kind of founding document, were bred, and quote, bred in at least modest comfort, now housed in universities, looking uncomfortably to the world we inherit. And they talked about ideas of participatory democracy, a revolution of values that would break out of that kind of conformity and monotony of the 1950s and early 1960s. It's worth noting how different that environment is from today. I mean, this was a period in which there had been 20 years of rising economic growth, in which the feeling was not that the problem was broke. In fact, Tom Hayden writes around this time that the leaders of our country seem to have overcome the kind of inequality and contradictions that led to the explosions of the 1930. The problem now seems to be that the machine is working too well. And you can think about Mario Savio's image of the machine that grinds you down as kind of the image of what capitalism was, and how different that is today when we've had 40 years of rising inequality and declining living standards for the majority of Americans. But that was the framework around the early politics of SDS and that were represented in the Port Huron Statement. The initial break comes not around those questions, but the initial break with the League for Industrial Democracy comes around the question of anti-communism. Part of the early rebellion of activists in SDS was against that kind of stultifying conformity of McCarthyism and anti-communism, and they went so far to say that they would be willing, that anti-communism was a barrier to rebuilding a new left, and they'd be working to work with anyone including people connected to the Communist Party, in their efforts to rebuild a new left. And that sent the League into apoplectic fits. In one of the conferences in the run-up to the Port Huron Statement, they had this debate where for days there were huge arguments about anti-communism. The League actually goes so far to cut off funding for SDS and change the locks on their doors so that they couldn't continue. And that really was the beginning of a break for SDS into a new direction. Many of the early members of SDS had participated in the civil rights movement, had gone to the solidarity protests with the sit-in movements of the early 1960s. And so as SDS embarked on a new direction, the first task they kind of set themselves was how to recreate and replicate the movement that had taken place in the South of the sit-ins and the early civil rights movement. How do you begin to translate that to other communities, and particularly in the North? And the first really activist project that SDS launches on is called ERAP, which I've now forgotten what it stands for. It's the Economic Research Action Project, is that what it was? And the idea was that members would go into low-income communities and cities around the North and try to build poor people's movements, try to organize around tenants' rights, try to organize around economic issues, and rebuild the kind of movement that had existed in the South in the cities of the North. That begins in 1963. By the end of 1964, it's really in pretty much all but one city in the country has ended in failure. People found that it was much harder to go into communities that you didn't have a connection to and organize mass movements. And that impasse is connected with a second impasse in the run-up to the 1964 elections, where SDS is, for a number of months, quite paralyzed by the question of what do you say about the endorsing Lyndon Johnson, who, of course, had been had been slow and at every turn been an impediment to the civil rights movement, and was now beginning to make noises about Vietnam. A number of the leaders of SDS were quite critical of Johnson and didn't want to endorse him, but didn't want to take a public position. So actually the national leadership of SDS didn't take any position on the endorsement, but the education project inside SDS went ahead and printed all of these buttons that then since have become kind of known as the slogan of SDS, which was half the way with LBJ. And it reflected, I think, two things that are still very common today. One was the idea that Johnson was the lesser evil to Barry Goldwater, who would be the greater evil in pretty much all scenarios short of Donald Trump, but this was a man who talked about the use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam. I mean, it was on the far right of the Republican Party of its day, although it would be comfortably, in the center right today of the Republican Party. But on the one hand, seeing Johnson as the lesser evil to that, and I think also the assumption that's very common today that you could continue to organize around social movements at the same time as you endorsed a Democrat, that those things weren't necessarily counterposed. And I've always thought it was interesting comparing the debates in SDS in 1964 with the debates in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1964, because SDS hadn't had very much direct contact with the Democratic Party, either in the Kennedy administration or in the prospective Johnson administration, but SNCC had, because even during the early sit-in, I'm sorry, even during the early Freedom Rides, it had been the Kennedy administration, particularly Bobby Kennedy, who had been sent to tell people that, look, we support civil rights, but, quote, stop this sitting in shit, and if you do, we'll get you tax-free status. And it seemed the ways that the Democrats had tried to say, we support your issues, but stop demonstrating. And then even more egregiously, I think, for activists inside SNCC, had been the experience of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, where people went down to Mississippi as part of the voter registration campaigns, organized black delegates to go to the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City in 1964 and say, we are the legitimate representatives of the Democratic Party in Mississippi, not the lily white Jim Crow delegation. And they were refused seats. And not only were they refused speech, eventually a compromise deal was hammered out that gave them only two people only observer status. And it was the liberal wing of the party that negotiated that. And I think for many people in SNCC saw that those two things were in contradiction, that these people weren't, were not certainly not neutral, but were also active participants in trying to limit and roll back the ability of the left to build social movements. So one of the leaders of SNCC at the time, Cleveland Sellers, has this quote coming out of Atlantic City where he says, "We would never again allow ourselves, never again were we lulled into believing that our task was simply exposing injustices so that the, quote, good people of America could eliminate them." After Atlantic City, our struggle was not for civil rights, it was for liberation. And that really broke SNCC on a much more radical direction. SDS would go through a similar process, I think, really beginning a year later. But two things for SDS really break through that impasse. One is the Berkeley Free Speech Movement. So in the fall of 1964, you have the explosion of protest in Berkeley. One of the members of the Independent Socialist Club, Jack Weinberg, is arrested or attempts to be arrested for tabling in support of the Congress of Racial Equality, in support of the civil rights movement in the South. And before he can be arrested, the car is surrounded by hundreds and hundreds of students who then stage a sit-in to prevent him from being arrested that lasts, I think, 36 hours, more than a day, that becomes an impromptu sit-in. And for activists in SDS, this becomes a kind of turn back to the campuses. You could see what a student movement could look like and the kind of power it could harness, both to draw in a whole new generation of students who are looking for a left alternative, as well as in the media to put forward a left critique of this country and a vision of what we could be fighting for. And the second thing that happens is the escalation in Vietnam. And of course, this begins under the Johnson administration, beginning in 1965, ramping up in 1966. Vietnam becomes what one leader of SDS calls the sharp cutting edge. It gives, as SDS is turning back to the campuses, it gives them a movement to organize around. And at their first national meeting, they decide on a national campaign against the war to begin with a protest in Washington. I believe it's the first national protest against the war. And initially, they think it's going to turn out a few thousand people and are blown away when 20,000 people turn out. And Paul Potter, who is the president at the time, gives a speech that I think gives a really good glimpse into what was happening in the minds of a whole new generation of people breaking from the outlook of their parents and realizing not only that they've been lied to about Vietnam, but if they've been lied to about that, there were a whole series of other things that they had been lied to. And it begins to raise much more fundamental questions about U.S. society. In his speech, he says, "The incredible war in Vietnam has provided the razor, the sharp, terrifying edge that has finally severed the last vestige of illusion that morality and democracy are the guiding principles of American foreign policy. The further we explore the reality of what this country is doing and planning in Vietnam, the more we are driven towards the conclusion that the United States may well be the greatest threat to peace in the world today." Unfortunately, just at the moment when SDS is beginning to take a national lead around the Vietnam War, they are paralyzed with a massive faction fight. As the result of the protests in DC and their organizing around the Vietnam War, they begin to explode in growth. They go from, I think, 8,000 members in 1964. By 1966, they have 25,000 members in more than 100 chapters around the country. It's an explosive growth. And while much of the early growth of SDS had been based on kind of liberal elite universities, most of the growth that takes place in the mid-1960s is in the Midwest, in the South, and largely on state schools, with a whole new layer of students who come into the organization, not necessarily with any connection to social democracy or the old left, but mainly from largely apolitical parents, and kind of representing the radicalism of people who had believed a lot of the lies of the late 50s and early 60s, then broken with them sharply, and bring a new infusion of radicalism, but also a new set of political ideas. And they organized themselves around a group called the Prairie Power faction, given the fact that most of them were based in schools in the Midwest and South. And there's really two parts to the Prairie Power faction. One is an argument for what they called student syndicalism, and this is put forward in a paper by Carl Davidson at their convention, which argues that the old coalition that had been advocated by the League for Industrial Democracy and some of the early leaders of SDS, of the trade union officialdom with the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, had really failed in its ability to push things forward, and that students were the ones who had the power to break capitalism, or to begin to challenge it at its root, that capitalism was based around a new white-collar workforce, and if you could disrupt the conveyor belt between the universities and that white-collar workforce, you could shake the system. But the other part that was actually more immediately influential was the argument that we shouldn't have national coordination, and that the national office shouldn't be directing the work of local committees. So the most immediate result was that chapters were sent off to organize on their own, and many chapters continued, particularly after 1966, to organize both around resistance to the draft, as well as opposition to military research taking place at the university, and led sit-ins and demonstrations and direct actions to shut them down that are quite inspiring, that people should read about. But at a national level, SDS ceased to play any role in organizing or directing the movement against the Vietnam War. And in the midst of this comes 1968. And 68, you know, as Daniel Singer, a French Marxist, put, was a year of revolutionary hope, which broke through again an impasse to give people both an idea of the horror that this system was capable of, but also hope in a different kind of alternative. You know, you think about, by 1968, people had been protesting for more than a decade. People had fought and won the dismantling of Jim Crow, only to then be confronted with the structural racism, economic inequality of both in the North and that continued in the South. Hundreds of thousands of people had marched and demonstrated against the Vietnam War. Beginning in the mid-1960s, for the first time, majorities polled in major cities in the United States show a majority of people, still not yet nationally, but certainly in key cities like Dearborn, Michigan, a majority of people opposing the Vietnam War. And yet the war not only continues to go on, but continues to escalate. There were 6,000 deaths in 1966, which would jump to 11 U.S. deaths, which would jump to 11,000 in 67, and then in 68 they would top over 16,000. It showed, on the one hand, the horror that the system was capable of, and for many people showed that in order to win even the most basic reforms, to win an end to the war, to win real equality and an end to racism, much more fundamental changes were going to be necessary to the structure of our society. But it also showed the possibilities of, you know, one way to look at the trajectory of SDS and other organizations in the 1960s was that once they broke from the idea of appealing to the existing power to change things, once you break with that idea that Cleveland Sellers talks about appealing to the people in power to change things, then the immediate question becomes, who has the power to do so? And you can see over the evolution of SDS them go through a whole series of, if it's not them, can we organize poor people in some form? If we can't do that, can we organize students in some form? A parallel thing is happening within the Black Power movement of, can we organize the black ghettos as a form of radical power to break through the system? And in each case, it runs up against the limitations of the social power of those groups. Certainly in the late 1960s, you have the massive ghetto uprisings, but even groups like SNCC and the Black Panthers are recognizing the limits of those movements. And so across the spectrum of organizations in the late 1960s, you have a move towards more radical politics. and a move towards revolutionary politics. And in particular, Paris 1968, I think for us, shows a different alternative to that. The power that can be wielded when movements of students and workers come together to pose a much more fundamental change to the system. Unfortunately, I think it was hard for many activists to imagine, even though many were inspired by Paris in 1968, how do you translate that, at least at that point, to the United States when the working class hadn't yet begun in any meaningful way to stir. And so unfortunately, the variant of revolutionary politics that most activists found was not revolutionary socialism or workers' self-emancipation, but one or another variant of Stalinism or Maoism. And to understand that in SDS, we have to backtrack just a little bit and look at a group called Progressive Labor, which was a pro-China split off from the American Communist Party, who dissolved their youth group, entered SDS in 1966, and because they were, in many cases, good organizers, they were certainly disciplined, were able to get a hearing among people looking for a more radical alternative. Their politics represented the worst of Stalinism. They talked about the importance of workers, but in the most distorted way. They encouraged the formation of worker-student alliances, but didn't even encourage people always to leave the campuses. The worker-students alliances were based on campus. They parroted some of the crudest stereotypes of the working class. They were notoriously hostile to women's rights and certainly to gay rights. And they denounced any kind of revolutionary nationalism as counter-revolutionary. So they were inimically hostile to groups like the Black Panthers and the NLF, and saw them as counter-revolutionary force. And like other groups within the Stalinist tradition, saw themselves as the one true representative of world revolution. But the fact that they were able to get a hearing among people, at least a minority of people in the SDS looking for an alternative, also put pressure on the national leadership to adopt some form of Marxism of their own to try to combat them. But as one SDS leader, Bill Ayers, wrote, PL kept growing in strength, and so I felt like we had to know some Marxism in order to talk to the Marxists. So we became Marxists ourselves, even though we were the silliest, least intellectual group of Marxists ever. But likewise, they adopt a competing form of kind of mixture of Maoism and Stalinism to compete. And this exacerbates all of the worst impulses of the student movement, the sort of we are more revolutionary than thou, the ultra-verbal radicalism, and the disconnection between student radicals and any wider forces on the campus. And this all comes to a head in the infamous 1969 National Conference, where the two factions go head to head. The National Office shows up with the Black Panther Party as kind of ringers to win the debate and win control of SDS. They get up and denounce PL, and then the Panthers totally go off script and start talking about how the main role of women in SDS should be to use their revolutionary power to not sleep with counter-revolutionary men, to which point other activists, not just the PLers, start denouncing male chauvinism, and the entire conference devolves into chaos. And at the end of the day, there's two competing conventions, one of the National Office, which renamed themselves the Revolutionary Youth League, that then splits to become the Revolutionary Youth RIM 1 and 2. And so now you have three groups, and it becomes sort of a bad Monty Python skit from The Life of Brian. And really the tragedy is that SDS implodes in 1969, just at the moment when the student movement and the workers' movement are about to explode into a much wider round of protest. In 1970, the war is expanded into Cambodia, and massive protests on campuses around the country break out, drawing in people who up until that point had not been part of the anti-war movement. In the crackdown after those demonstrations is when we have four students killed at Kent State and two at Jackson State in Mississippi, which is talked about much less. And in response to that is the national student strike, which to date is the largest student strike in the history of this country. And in the beginning of the 1970s, you also have the beginnings of the first rumblings within the U.S. working class. The radicalism that had taken place throughout the 1960s begins to go back into the factories, largely on the heels of young workers entering the factories who were radicalized and influenced by the new left, and a series of important strikes, beginning with the Standard Oil strike in California, and then to auto, the post office, the Wildcats in the post office. The tragedy is that the 100,000 radicals that had been organized into SDS had very little connection to those struggles. The majority of people probably dropped out of organized politics, and the Maoist groups that emerged from that didn't have a way forward for those struggles. I will say, and maybe we can get into more in the discussion, there were some important exceptions to that. There were members of the Independent Socialist Club and later the IS who were part of SDS, and in a couple of key places like City College in New York and in the Bay Area did play an important role in putting forward the ideas of socialism from below as an alternative and did get a hearing. But we're talking about a group that even in 1968 was a few dozen members in SDS. And so I think, you know, when we take lessons, I think we have to look at both the positives and negatives. Certainly looking back at SDS shows that even in our most recent history, and the 60s still remains the reference point for many young activists today, the types of challenges, the questions around the Democratic Party, the question of who has the social power to make radical change in this country, all of those are questions that we are coming up against today and will continue to come up against today. And I think looking at the debates that took place in SDS show the influence radical and Marxist ideas can have in providing a way forward, but we also have to look critically at the type of Marxism that became dominant in the late 1960s and to say that, you know, the best politics don't always win out. It matters how rooted and how large the left is in being able to provide a pole of attraction and being able to influence those struggles as they move forward. And then I think most importantly is to say one of the, although there's many parallels I think you can draw with the movements of the 1960s, the biggest difference is that the 1960s came on the heels of 30 years of, or 25 years of economic growth, an expansion of the capitalist system, whereas today we are trying to rebuild a new left after 40 years of growing inequality and economic decline, where most young people not only don't expect their lives to be better off than their parents, but know that their parents' lives are worse off than their grandparents. And so I think that produces a different starting point. Many of the same questions will have to be faced. But it does say something that in the 1960s, those working class strikes and upheavals really only began towards the later part of the 1960s. Now we certainly have echoes of the 1960s in movements like Black Lives Matter, Me Too, the new movements against sexism for, you know, queer and trans rights, and against sexism and racism. But we also saw the teachers' strike at the very beginning of a period of radicalization. And so it means that in some ways, our challenge is more daunting. We are trying to rebuild a new left from virtually scratch, but one in which the ideas of solidarity, inequality, and building a movement of the 99%, the idea of class politics, is much more at the center of the movement, even at its very beginning. It's our job to work alongside people in these struggles and also to argue for a way forward based on the ideas of socialism from below and working class self-emancipation. Thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.